Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. It is a great pleasure to have with us once again, now from Israel, a man whose intelligence on matters of great import to the future course of the war for the free world I have long valued and been proud to share with this audience periodically. He is Dr. Harold Rode. For many years, he was one of the senior and most respected authorities on the Middle East. And by that, I mean the larger region of the Middle East, including Turkey, for the Department of Defense. These days, he is a senior fellow with a highly regarded institution in the United States, the Gatestone Institute. A distinguished senior fellow at that, and very much a valued contributor to our programming as well. Harold Rode, it's great to catch up with you. Thank you very much for your time.
Wonderful being with you, Frank, and thanks for all the beautiful introduction there.
Well, it is both heartfelt and deserved. I'm asking you today, probably mostly, if not entirely, to address yourself to what has happened in the past week in Turkey. But before we get into the recent events, I'd like to ask you for a little bit of background on who this chap is, Recep Tayyip Erdogan, the now president of Turkey. Where did he come from? What are his views and aspirations, as best they can be defined? And then we'll get into what he's up to at the moment.
Well, first of all, he comes from a poor neighborhood in Istanbul. He's a very charismatic man, and from his youth has been an Islamic fundamentalist. He has always been a strong brother, a strong member, and supporter of the Muslim Brotherhood. And that is a pan-Muslim, pan-Islamic national group. The goals of which are very simple, that all of the world must come under Islamic rule, eventually convert to Islam, be ruled by a caliph, and under Sharia, the Muslim holy law. That's Erdogan's long-term goal. He grew up, he was a member of a party, which in the 1990s, a fundamentalist party, headed by a man by the name of Erbakan. And Erbakan tried to, shall we say, he became prime minister, and he tried to Islamify, return Turkey to its politically Islamic roots, like the Ottoman Empire, which was the center of the entire Sunni world, which is today it's 86% of the 1.456 billion Muslims. We really don't know how many there are in the world. The man, as far as I'm concerned, was always dangerous. When he was a member, and let's say a protege of this Erbakan, Erbakan tried to Islamify Turkey or re-Islamify Turkey politically very quickly. The military then had what was called an e-coup, an electronic coup. And the people who were in his party, like, for example, Erdogan, realized that if you want to do this, because they have the same goals, Islamify Turkey and all, you have to do it slowly, because if you do it too quickly, you will alienate the military, which at the time was strong, and more importantly, the United States. Now, the United States is always, unfortunately, looking for moderates. That's a nice Western term. In the middle, there are no moderates. The only question is what methods you use to get your goals done. So Erdogan at first became mayor of Istanbul, and then prime minister. And I would say that the American government, this thing that moderate Islam, whatever that is, we have to make peace with it, we have to deal with it. So our then ambassador in the 90s met with Erbakan, and we thought we're just being, you know, that it's the right thing to do because we're meeting all forces. On one level, that's correct. But in the Middle East, meeting with someone gives him, you're in essence saying he's kosher and that you support him.
Legitimacy and...
That's what we did.
Yes.
Legitimacy.
Essentially
thank you. That's
endorsing.
The best word.
Harold Rode, let me ask you about this. There is a famous quote attributed to Erdogan about his attitude towards democracy as a means of advancing this goal. Talk about that, if you would.
Since we dubbed him a moderate and we dealt with him and all that, we refused to see him for what he was. And he did tell us who he was, even if we didn't want to hear. For example, one of the things that he said is that democracy is like a railroad train. You get on it, and you take it as far as you need to go, and then you get off, and you proceed. In other words, your mission is the Islamification of the world. If democracy is the way going to help you on that path, then you use it. When democracy is no longer useful, you abandon it. And that is what has happened in the last week.
You talked about two impediments to Turkey's Islamicization, if I can use that expression. The military of Turkey, that it had traditionally been its the guarantor of sort of Ataturk's secular Muslim state, and the United States. And to the extent that you can, just quickly, describe how Erdogan used democracy to essentially neutralize both of those obstacles to his ambition.
Well, America likes to see anybody who speaks the holy language, which is English, and who is a member or claims to be moderate and claims to say all the things we want, that he really... It's just like us. Now, Erdogan doesn't speak English, but he and the people around him knew exactly how to bamboozle America, America's diplomats especially, even its intelligence people. They refused to see Erdogan for what he really was.
And this, by the way, precedes President Obama's tenure, in which the president has described Erdogan as one of his best foreign friends, as I recall. So this is a bipartisan failure, not simply one of the Democrats at the moment. And this was very much manifested, Harold Rode, as I recall, and you were intimately involved in all of this, I think. At the time that the United States was preparing to invade Iraq to contend with Saddam Hussein after the 9/11 attacks, give us a flavor of what happened in that moment, Harold, between Turkey and the United States.
America, from 9/11 on, and let's say what's most importantly, the war in 2003 for the liberation of Iraq, we assumed that Turkey would be on our side. And what happened was Erdogan controlled the ruling party in parliament at the time. And when it came up for a vote, the idea of letting America use or being part of the coalition to invade Iraq also from the north, it lost by 3 votes. Now, I want to tell you the way political parties work in the Middle East. They are subservient to the head of the party. Unfortunately, the cunning of Mr. Erdogan was that when it lost, he blamed the military. And the truth is that some of our senior people, especially Frank in the building where you and I worked, blamed.
Harold Rode, we will pause for just a minute. When we come back, I want to talk with you about what has happened under Erdogan in the past week and his response to this so-called coup by the military, what you make of the coup and what you think is coming next. That and much more with Dr. Harold Rode of the Gatestone Institute, formerly with the Department of Defense, right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
This is Fred Fleitz with the Center for Security Policy. According to the New York Times, President Obama said during a rare visit to the CIA to discuss the second phase in the battle against ISIS on April 13th, that the U.S.-led coalition had momentum against ISIS and that ISIS fighters realize their cause is lost. But the previous day, the New York Times ran a story with the headline, ISIS expands reach despite military and financial setbacks, noting that although ISIS has suffered losses on the ground in Iraq and Syria, it has expanded its presence in northern Africa, Afghanistan, and Europe. There also has been little progress in stopping ISIS's efforts to recruit homegrown terrorists worldwide. The president is in denial about the threat from ISIS. His trip to the CIA, which should have occurred 5 years ago when the violence broke out in the Middle East, was little more than a publicity stunt. I'm Fred Fleitz. Learn more at securefreedom.org.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back. We're visiting with Dr. Harold Rode of the Gatestone Institute, truly one of the country's preeminent authorities on Turkey and indeed much of the Middle East, a man who served with great distinction in the Defense Department as a specialist in these matters, including the Turkish desk officer, as I recall, for a time. And, Harold, we were talking about sort of the run-up to the events of a week ago, which resulted in something called a coup. I'm interested in your take on what happened. Was it, in fact, a military coup, as it's been described, or perhaps something else?
Frank, I like the way you put that. I'm not sure it was a coup. I can explain that, but let me what happened. If you're going to have a coup, number one, you go after the leader. Number two, you go after the media. And the thing was totally bungled. And I wondered from the beginning the way it was done. Was it, in fact, did Erdogan initiate this just like Hitler did so he could use it as an opportunity to take power, to take make absolute power. In fact, Erdogan himself said he wanted to have power, the same type of power that Hitler did.
Yeah, he specifically made reference to Hitler's kind of power. And of course, the Reichstag fire, I think, is what you're talking about, Harold Rode, which led to a consolidation of power by Adolf Hitler. And so to the extent that, and Harold, we're going to have to pause here in a moment, but to the extent that Erdogan might have engineered this for that purpose, was he in fact able to do so with the help of the military, or was this really just a manufactured group operating under sort of military color?
Well, let me tell you, Nathan Sharansky, who was a Soviet dissident and had been in jail for many years as a Soviet dissident, and then he was later an Israeli government minister, he says that in situations like this, the Soviets would also have these pretend coups or pretend counter-government demonstrations. And the goal was to smoke out the enemies, to find, and who would then appear, and then the Soviets would know who afterwards to arrest, who to go after.
We're visiting with Harold Rode of the Gatestone Institute, and Harold, you were talking about the Soviet practice. This is, I guess, something well known to authoritarians of various stripes. You also mentioned Hitler's use of a similar kind of technique. So give us a flavor of what actually happened as best we can reconstruct it in Istanbul and other parts of Turkey.
Well, the actual thing of what happened is unclear, but what is clear is the results. All of a sudden, in the education ministry, Erdogan, which basically is educating people for the future, he either arrested or fired 15,200 people from the education ministry. He has demanded that and all university rectors have been relieved of their positions. He has demanded that all Turks who are teaching abroad, all academic professors, return home. And what he's doing is clearly had lists of people prepared already. That's what makes me suspect whether, in fact, it was a coup. And his goal is simply, he's arresting huge numbers of people. People don't know what to do. And because America say he was democratically elected, we must remember Hitler was democratically elected. Hitler in a free and fair election. I'm not sure whether Erdogan's election was free and fair, but what was fair, what was sure is there was an election. And so when the American government says that the military and everybody else must respect the will of the people and the election results, I can't believe that we could be so stupid.
Yeah. Harold, let me ask you about one of the players in this drama, of course, Fethullah Gulen. A man who is currently residing in the United States, from which he runs quite an empire, to the extent that he figures prominently in Erdogan's machinations, why would that be?
Well, they used to work together, but they're both fundamentalist Muslims, but in different ways. The reason that Gulen fled to the United States, and I think it was somewhere around 1999, is that the military had recorded him at a private gathering saying, we will use democracy, we will tell the West everything it wants to hear, we will patiently wait, and eventually we will take over. He fled, he was given asylum, I think that's the right word, in the United States, and he resides something like 50 or 60 miles north of Philadelphia. Now, the point is that he has a lot of followers in Turkey. He's got a lot of followers throughout the entire Turkic world, which involves anywhere from Xinjiang province in China, northwest China, to the Adriatic Sea, wherever Turks are. Education empire, financial empire. He's got a lot of supporters. In the Middle East, when people take power, whatever means they use to, they need to eliminate eventually all those who could possibly stand up to them. And so Gulen is a potential problem because he does have a lot of support within Turkey, at least, and in other places.
And in particular, Harold wrote, as I understand it, among the kind of people that you've indicated these purges are affecting, the educational community, the teachers, professors, administrators, police, jurists, and others. And these are all being rounded up and fired, as I understand. Is that
correct? Yes, you're absolutely right. And he is now demanding that the United States extradite Gulen to Turkey, where they'll probably assassinate, eliminate, whatever torture. I'm not sure what they do. Well, then the Americans, to the American government's credit, are saying, what's the evidence? Give us the evidence that he was behind this terrorist, what they call this terrorist plot to take over Turkey, to overthrow Erdogan. And if we see the evidence is true, then we will go through our legal procedures to do so. Erdogan, the point is that Erdogan says he's guilty. Well, our response is, what's the evidence? In the Middle East, you don't need evidence. When the powerful leader says it, that's the answer. And here we have, again, a clash of cultures between Turkey In fact, the whole Muslim world and the United States.
Harold Rowe.
Maybe he is.
Let me ask you about a detail about Gulen, because, of course, he not only has an educational empire and other businesses in Turkey and parts of the Turkic world, but here in the United States. And one of the arguments that's being made not to extradite him and to otherwise enable him to continue to operate something like 160, I believe it is, charter schools across the United States is that he is a moderate Muslim, a Sufi Muslim. And yet what you've said about the identity of views of Gulen's agenda and Erdogan's, they've had a falling out over power, of course, but talk, if you would, very quickly about, actually, we're going to have to go to a break. When we come back, I want you to help explicate what it means if this fellow is, in fact, a Sufi, if anything, in terms of the challenge that he might represent to the non-Islamist world, the Muslim as well as non-Muslim community of nations who don't want to live under Sharia, as I believe he thinks we all ought to. Harold Rowe is our guest from the Gatestone Institute. We're talking Turkey, and we'll do more of it right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Last Thursday, President Obama celebrated the end of the Muslim period of fasting known as Ramadan. The company he kept on the occasion spoke volumes about his sympathies, not simply towards Islam, but for Islamic supremacism. Now, Team Obama treats the White House invitation list as a more closely held state secret than Hillary Clinton did actual highly classified information. But a number of known stealthy civilization jihadists used the occasion to share via social media the fact that they were, once again, inside the wire. As important, and as usual, Mr. Obama excluded pro-American, anti-jihad Muslim reformers from his celebration. The message to their community could not be more clear. Those tied to the terrorist Muslim Brotherhood are your leaders. It is exceedingly undesirable and dangerous for such a message to be assiduously conveyed by the President of the United States. This is Frank Gaffney.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Harold Rowe is our guest. We're very pleased to have him joining us from Israel, where he is in residence at the moment and monitoring closely what's happening not too far away in Turkey, a country in which he is an acknowledged expert in our country. And Harold, I wanted just to get at this question of whether Fethullah Gulen is in fact a moderate Muslim, as we're being told by some of his advocates and some of his followers.
Well, the word moderate we love to hear in the West. I'm not sure what it means in the Middle Eastern context, because it's really, frankly, meaningless. He is a Turkic Muslim nationalist. He believes that the Turkish form, or the Turkic, that's the entire Turkic world, form of Islam is the correct one. And he doesn't particularly like the Arabs. Erdogan has a combination of everybody together, sort of supporting the Muslim Brotherhood. The two of them don't disagree on the eventual outcome, which is the whole world should live under Islam, under a caliph and under Sharia. But they don't agree on the way to get there. Another group is ISIS. They have the same goals. Again, but their methods of reaching those goals are different. And a lot of the other groups are obsessed with finding this is a moderate, this is an extremist. They all have the same goals, but they believe that where the fight is among them is to the methods that they use. The Saudis, the same thing. The Saudis are Wahhabis. They're a radical form of Islam. It would be very nice for them that they all fight each other and let them work it out together.
It also seems, and Harold, you are, again, one of the people who understands all this better than just about anybody in our country, they're perfectly prepared to make common cause when it suits them against the infidel, notably us. And whatever their tactical differences may be, it is the overarching strategic objective and Sharia that binds them, is it not?
It's true, and they hate each other. And in the Middle East, there are never any such thing as bygones be bygones. And so the battle between the Shiites and Sunnis, which started when their prophet Muhammad died, and it boiled down to who should then rightfully be the head of Islam thereafter. That means the caliph. The Sunnis say it should be Muhammad's family, and the Shiites say it should be the aristocracy of Mecca, which was the center of Islam. Now, to us, that happened long ago. We have this phrase in English, that's history. But in the Middle East, there's no such thing as that's history. Nothing is ever solved. There's never any peace. And so you wait until you are strong enough, and then you've killed. You eliminate your enemy. That's the way it's done. I'm not saying it's good or bad. I'm simply describing the reality. Now,
it seems pretty bad to me, especially since we're the enemy of choice.
But Frank, that's true. But remember that during the age of the Soviet Union, there were times that the CIA and the KGB worked on joint missions together when they both thought it was in their common interest to do so. But they, in the long run, they had very different interests. That's the story of the Shiites and the Sunnis. They hate each other with a passion, and they each consider themselves the other should be dead. But, you know, Osama bin Laden, his family, they're Sunnis. They were extreme Sunnis. And they were housed in Iran because it was hard for the Americans to get to them for a period of time. The family acknowledged that, and Iran eventually acknowledged that. No, they both hated each other, but they hated America as well.
Let me come back to Turkey, Harold, because there's several things I really want to make sure we cover before we run out of time. Just finish up this thought on Gulen. So the likelihood is whether Erdogan actually inspired and executed this coup, or whether he simply is capitalizing on a very hapless operation that seems to be very, very unlike the Turkish military, even after all these years of infiltration and subversion by Erdogan. These folks are now being rounded up, as are others who aren't evidently associated with Gulen, but who are simply seen as opponents of Erdogan's regime. To the end that there is now underway, it would appear, a very, very serious consolidation of power and quite possibly a huge stride forward towards a really Islamist republic. Is that your judgment as well?
Let me just put it this way. The great Bernard Lewis is probably the greatest Middle Eastern historian alive. He's now over 100. Said back in the 90s. That he could imagine a situation where Turkey and Iran switch places, that Iran leaves behind its Islamic Republic and joins again the Community of Nations, and that Turkey becomes an Islamic force to again try to lead the whole Muslim world in the battle of Islamifying the entire world. That's the direction that Erdogan wants to take it. But Erdogan has also threatened the President of the United States. He said, if we do not give him back Gulen, if we send it back to Turkey, that will have a terrible impact on U.S.-Turkish relations. Now, let me just tell you, there's a Turkish proverb that it's sort of like you're either all-powerful or kissing someone's feet. And this, you know, all of a sudden, Erdogan, by winning or taking over the way he has now, thinks that he's not only the chief dog on the block, or whatever the right phrase is, but he is going to dictate to the United States and NATO what the rules of the game are. It is extremely important from a policy point of view that we make it clear to Mr. Erdogan that if there's anybody that in the end makes the rules and we're not working together, in the end, we got to pull rank because America is the greatest and the most powerful nation on the face of the earth. And who the hell, if you'll excuse me, is this pipsqueak Erdogan to tell America, try to push America around?
Well, this remains to be seen, but it would certainly fit the pattern of policy under President Obama that he would submit.
Unfortunately, this kind of
aggressive and belligerent behavior by even a fellow that's supposedly subordinate and an ally to boot. Harold, one place where this may well come to a head, as I understand it, is with respect to the American use of a Turkish airbase at Incirlik. We've had reported that there are nuclear weapons stored at that facility. I don't know that that's been confirmed because the U.S. government doesn't do that. And as former government employees, neither you nor I will probably say anything about that. But it just does raise to a heightened level of concern what they might do. They've already cut off the power, as I understand it, to Incirlik, and obviously shut down the air operations against the so-called Syrian, based Islamic State. But what do you think is likely to eventuate there?
We have a treaty, Establish the Forces Agreement, with Turkey on how we are able to use Incirlik, the base there. If they are violating the treaty, then we should violate the treaty. They're declaring the treaty null and void. If they dare do what, I don't know about the electric thing, but if they're doing that, our response should be to make sure we must, if there are nuclear weapons there or whatever, we must ensure the security of the safety of our people. I want to tell you as an aside that when the president of Iraqi Kurdistan, Barzani, a few years ago came to the United States, Barzani's people told me that they offered President Obama two American bases, wherever they wanted, to replace Incirlik if something went wrong with their relations with Turkey. And unfortunately, our president said no. It is the only serious base we have in that area. But I guess if necessary, we cannot let these people, this tyrant, this dictator, this Islamic fundamentalist radical, dictate to us the way things are going to be. We have a treaty with them. We love signed documents. In the Middle East, signed documents are useless. Nothing more than a step.
All right, Harold, we're going to take that to the next step in just a moment. We'll be right back with more in our final segment with Harold Rode of the Gatestone Institute, one of the country's preeminent authorities on Turkey. Right after this.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back for a final segment of a very special, important, and extended conversation with Dr. Harold Rode, a man I've known for many years in terms of both our overlapping service and that he continued to perform in the Pentagon's senior ranks as one of really the duty experts for our government on matters involving the Middle East in general and Turkey and Iran in particular. And Harold, you were just describing this practice of treaties being very differently regarded in the West by the United States, most especially, and by our counterparts in the Middle East. I'm interested in particular in, of course, the future of the U.S.-Turkish relationship and the broader Turkish participation in NATO as well. What are your thoughts as to where this is likely to lead if Erdogan has his way?
Well, I'm not a prophet, but I have some thoughts of what might be here. First of all, since paper agreements mean nothing in the Middle East. They're nothing more than steps along the way to get to where they want. Erdogan's goal is to use us, to use America, to use NATO, to use whatever, to get as far as he wants. And like the train of democracy we talked about earlier, to get off. I know what his long-term goals are. I know that he's had the patience to get as far as he has, and as such lulled us into lying to ourselves on what his real goals were. That, no, he really wasn't going to be, he wasn't the fundamentalists, he wasn't this, he was a moderate. There are no moderates when it comes to fundamentalist Islam. It's absurd. I don't know how he wants to get there, but he wants to rule the world. I know that sounds megalomaniac, but it is how he thinks. How do I know that? I've only met him once. I can't say that personally. It's that if you listen to his speeches, if you listen to the way he talks, and you understand the context, the Islamic fundamentalist context in which he talks and how he functions, then it all makes perfect sense. I don't know what the future holds. I know what he wants. And if I were the United States, if I were Russia, most of whose Muslims, of the former Soviet Union's Muslims, are some form of Turkish Muslim. If I were China, which is one-sixth of it, is the province of Xinjiang, the native population of which are Uyghurs, which is another Turkic group. If I were them, if I were Israel, which has to deal all the time with Islamic fundamentalists, if I were Europe, which is being taken over by Muslims, which Erdogan has a huge hand, Europe, under Muslim control, and then the idea of what they're doing in the United States as well. If slowly but surely, Erdogan and all the Wahhabis funded by a lot of the people in the Persian Gulf, the Arabs in the Persian Gulf, and the Saudi government, and a lot of senior Saudi businessmen, wealthy, they are funding the idea of eventually bringing the entire world under Islamic rule. And that's the long-term goal. How it's going to happen and when it's going to happen, we must recognize this. If we recognize this is the reality, then we must come up with a strategy to deal with this, which means the Islamic fundamentalists must be defeated, not in our terms, but in their understanding. Frankly, that needs to have to be eradicated. That's the right word, eradicated. We must call them the enemies as for who they are, label them for who they are, and then act accordingly.
Harold, this is it does sound fantastic that they could think this. And yet, as you say, even in the past few years, the progress that they have made, notably in Europe, is unmistakable. And let's just talk about that for a moment, because, of course, the Erdogan regime has brought that crisis about in Europe. There were a lot of Turks there to begin with, particularly in Germany. But what Erdogan has engineered in terms of bringing many, many more in through Turkey and otherwise creating conditions through which others would come in from Libya and so on has changed the demographics of Europe for sure. There's a talk now, of course, as a result of the deal that he struck with Angela Merkel, that Turks will be given visa-free travel in Europe. Give us a sense of what the implications of that might be, especially if, as has been reported, there's something like 300,000 Syrians that he is going to naturalize as Turks and thereby make eligible for such travel as well.
Well, Erdogan has engineered a win-win situation for him against Europe, against Angela Merkel, probably the most powerful leader in Europe. And this is how he's done it. First of all, he allowed before all these refugees to go through Turkey from Afghanistan, Iraq, from Syria, from wherever. These are Muslims, and I know that our news has shown women and children and all that, but about 70 to 80% of them are not with women and children, and they're not married. What they are is young men, somewhere between the ages of 15, 16 to about 35. In other words, the high testosterone group. And these people are flooding into Europe ISIS itself says that they have people among the refugees. That's wrong. So that would bring the day of reckoning of Islam taking over Europe closer than Erdogan was pushing that. Now he's come up with an agreement with Angela Merkel, with Germany, which says we will keep the refugees in camps, but in return for money for 6 billion euros and visa-free travel that you just mentioned, Frank, throughout Europe. There are 75 to 80 million Turks. Whatever the way it is, this is a win-win situation of getting more Muslims into Europe. And again, Muslims have patience. That's how they work. Slowly but surely, they mind their own business until there's a critical mass. And then they make commands from Sharia courts in their areas. Halal food. Imagine in Germany not eating pork. I mean, that's absurd. It's a major staple in the German diet. So there's schools in Germany now who no longer serve pork in deference to the Muslims. They don't have any deference to anybody else. My point is that it's a win-win situation that Erdogan has engineered. You must admire the man's cunning.
Yes. And there's no question, Harold Rode, in your mind that this is part of his longer-term agenda. And indeed, as you say, the same agenda of jihadists throughout the world under whatever stripe, the violent kind or the Muslim Brotherhood civilization kind, to, in fact, achieve the end state that they believe is God's will, namely that Sharia rule the world under a caliph of some kind. So, Harold Rode, just in closing, we've got less than a minute, but the developments in Turkey of the past week seem to signal a great leap forward, if I can use that expression, in terms of this Islamist agenda. Quickly, what would your recommendation be to the kind of people you served in the past in the Pentagon or the President of the United States to do about this?
Use the, at first, military, since we're in a situation where really, really getting out of hand. We must eradicate their bases. We must shame them. We must humiliate them so people realize that this, if you want to do these things against us, you will pay.
Yeah, and as I understand it, this is the one basis under Sharia under which they are allowed to give up the jihad, is if they recognize that there is no hope to it. Harold Rode, thank you very much, as always, for your time and your insights, as well as your vision for what we need to be doing. I look forward to talking with you further in the near future. In the meantime, our very best to you and the people of Israel. Enjoy your stay there and be safe. The rest of you will be, I hope, staying tuned as we talk with Gordon Chang about some very important developments that are also of interest to us in another part of the world, the South China Sea. That and more straight ahead.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. I'm very pleased to say we are joined by one of our favorites, one of our regulars, one of our most distinguished contributors. He is Gordon Chang, our duty expert here at Secure Freedom Radio on matters involving Asia and our very considerable interests in that part of the world. Gordon is similarly highly valued by such outfits as Forbes.com, where he writes a column, The Daily Beast, where he is a regular contributor, and, of course, World Affairs Journal, where he blogs, among other places, and indeed frequently at Fox News. And we're always delighted to have him with us. Gordon, thank you very much for finding a few minutes for us.
Thank you, Frank.
Well, I know you are following closely the ongoing and still very dynamic response of the Chinese to this ruling by the International Tribunal of the Law of the Sea Treaty that essentially found pretty much across the board against them with respect to their claims to the South China Sea. Let's look at this, if we might, initially, Gordon, this response, in terms of how the Chinese treated our top naval officer, the chief of naval operations, during a recent visit to China.
CNO Admiral John Richardson was in Beijing in the beginning part of this week, and the Chinese gave him a very difficult reception. Before he arrived, one of China's top admirals said that American freedom of navigation operations could end, quote-unquote, in disaster. And then when he was there, China's top admiral, in other words, Richardson's counterpart, said that China would continue to reclaim without stopping in the Spratly Islands. And so this was a direct affront to the United States. There were a number of other hostile actions. And I think that the administration should have ordered Richardson to leave after he was disrespected so much by the Chinese. And Richardson was there to talk about cooperation, trying to make sure the region remained stable, and the Chinese just went out of their way to insult him.
Talk about the loss of face and what it means in Chinese society when you are humiliated in this fashion and seemingly walk away as though it never happened.
Well, Frank, you described that very well. But what the Chinese are trying to do is to show to their own public how tough they are and that they can humble the United States. And so this is a psychological game. Now, we always take the position, administration in and administration out, that we are there to provide peace and security and that the Chinese, and this is to the benefit of the Chinese. But, you know, after decades of their not getting it, I think that we need to rethink what we're doing. Obviously, it's not working. The Chinese are becoming much more belligerent and provocative over time. They intend to humiliate the United States. And we act as if, you know, our policies are working, but obviously they're not. Which is not to say that a change in policy is going to do any better, but we need to do something because the region is sliding into conflict, and we are not recognizing that.
Is it not the case when you get away with humiliating an adversary that in China that is emboldening? That is exactly the kind of response you should expect is more aggressiveness, not less. I guess this goes to the heart of perhaps a cultural disconnect between us, but we may think that we're taking the high road and perhaps even deterring the Chinese by not rising to the bait. And yet, Gordon, am I wrong that the Chinese almost certainly see this as an invitation to be still more belligerent?
Absolutely, Frank. And we have seen this pattern so many times in the last 4 years, you know, most notably with our allowing the Chinese to take Scarborough Shoal. We thought we could avoid confrontation then and maintain peace in the region, but the Chinese just saw a big green light for their ambitions. They saw no pushback, and so therefore they ramped up pressure on Second Thomas Shoal, which is another Philippine feature, as well as the Senkaku in East China Sea. So now it made the problem bigger, and, you know, we have no clue. You know, we continue with these policies, ignoring the cultural and as well as the geopolitical aspects of this, and so it's no surprise. And as I've always said, you know, the Chinese are villains, but we have allowed them to be villains, and we have not stopped them. So it's on us.
Gordon, one of the things that, of course, is now very much in play is the struggle between the Philippines, which brought the suit against the Chinese in the Law of the Sea Tribunal, and the Chinese in the aftermath of this ruling. What is the current state of those two nations' relationships in these disputed waters?
A few days ago, Beijing offered to negotiate with the Philippines, but it insisted that those negotiations not be on the basis of the July 12th arbitral award. The administration of new president Rodrigo Duterte said, yes, we'd be willing to talk, but it's got to be on the basis of that award. And so no negotiations are occurring. this is the proper response of Manila. And we weren't sure which way the administration would go because it has said every possible thing about the Chinese, from very good things to very bad things. So this is a positive sign. Now, Beijing's reaction, of course, with regard to the Philippines has been extremely hostile, sending its fishing craft into Philippine waters, as well as ramping up pressure on Scarborough Shoal, which it seized in 2012. Both of those are violations of the arbitral award, and Manila has got to respond in some way, but it needs our assistance to do so. And really, so the ball is in Manila's court, and we need to work very closely with President Duterte.
Now, in your column in Forbes magazine this week, Gordon, you talked about this practice by the Chinese of sending their fishing ships into other nations' waters as a new way to tank their economy. Is that the way in which the Philippines and the United States and others in the region should respond, is really through economic retaliation against the Chinese, do you think?
I think that we're going to absolutely have to do that because the Chinese have shown that there really is no way to talk to them. You know, their initial responses have all been very provocative, from disrespecting CNO Admiral Richardson to everything else. And so we are really left with very few other ways to push the Chinese in better directions. This is going to be a long-term struggle. It's going to require political will, which we don't have in our parties right now. And so this is going to be, I think, the highest test of American diplomacy. But we do need to use coercive measures. Fortunately, the Chinese economy is in trouble, so that does give us a way into this. And we're just going to have to be willing to act like we did during the Cold War with resolution and purpose.
You mentioned parties, plural, I think, Gordon Chang. Was your takeaway from the Republican convention that the Trump-Pence ticket is no more likely to be robust about China's predations in the South China Sea and East China Sea, for that matter, than has been the Obama administration?
Trump did not talk about the South China Sea, but clearly Beijing favors him, and they've done that recently because Trump has talked about a couple things that are high on their agenda. Not the South China Sea, but Trump has talked about breaking the treaty relationships with South Korea and Japan, and that's absolutely what they want because they can see that the natural consequence of what Trump wants to do will be the U.S. exiting the region, and that's been their goal all along. So they're very much on his side. And indeed, we got to remember that the Russian state media also has been favoring Trump because Trump has a much softer position with regard to Moscow than the Clinton team. So this is something that's going to be very interesting for us to watch. I mean, we don't know how either of these candidates would react if they were president, but clearly Moscow and Beijing are betting that they'll be much better under a Trump administration than a Clinton one.
Gordon, we have to leave it at that for the moment. I appreciate so much your time. As always, your thoughts and insights each week on what is developing in Asia and what it means for us are deeply appreciated. Keep up the good work, my friend. Come back to us again very soon. I hope the rest of you will do the same on Monday. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.